Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to Paul Duncan, who has been on the show before, and he is here to talk about his new book, which is a wonderful passion edition of Dr. No, which gives you an in-depth day-by-day analysis of the filmmaking process for the first James Bond film. It's a wonderful book, gorgeous to look at, and hopefully there'll be also a sort of cheaper version out in the near future. But until then, you can enjoy the fruits of Paul's researches via this conversation. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to like, subscribe, do all those things that make Writers on Film the biggest podcast in the world. And also, I'd like to point out that Cinema Italia is available now. There's a new season ongoing, a look and celebration into Italian cinema, which is available from everywhere you get your podcasts. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation. Ian Fleming. I was interested to read in...
Because you've just read the novels, haven't you?
No, what I've done is I've bought them all in these beautiful editions, which I don't think are the first editions, although I have got some of those first edition paperbacks as well. I mean, they won't be first edition, it'll be reprint, but with that cover art. I'm not too keen on that cover art because that isn't the cover art that I remember as a kid. When I was a kid, and I'm talking about like 9, 10, 11, I was still in elementary school. There was like a secondhand bookshop in the village that, and I went and they just had like a pile of these pans.
Yeah, they all did.
5p. And so I just got them all and read through them or tried to read them. I was way too young to be reading them just in terms of, you know, it's so weird getting them now because Live and Let Die, when I was that age, it's like going back to your elementary school. I remember this being a really thick book and it's not all. But I remember like struggling to get through it. But so I collected them to just have them physically. And now I'm waiting, I guess, until the summer because I've reread them like about 10 years ago. I read them all when I was a kid, reread them about 10 years ago, and now I'm ready to reread them again. And I was thinking maybe of even doing a little blog or something about the...
Of course you will.
you know.
you're going to do a podcast. I know you.
Yeah.
You're going to start a new one, right? You're going to do subsets. You know, there's going to be a whole list of your podcasts, and they're going to be subsets. It's going to be, you'll need a bibliography in order to keep up with all these
key to all mythologies is my, I'm like the guy from Middlemarch who wants to just have everything connected somehow podcast-wise. No, absolutely. I've got a Terrence Malick podcast brewing as well for the publication of the book. So that
would be...
But I was reading in your Dr. No, in sort of the first chapter where you're talking about Ian Fleming, it's so interesting to see that this is a character who's created by a man who's just about to get married. And that was a bit of an aha moment for me.
Yeah, it was like, it's the idea of fantasy, you know, the fantasy of what would his life have been like if he had been a spy, if he wasn't married, if he wasn't tied down to a place or tied down by money worry. You never see James Bond having money worries. And yeah, it is a complete fantasy object in that sense. I think you're quite right. And I think that what's interesting about the novels, as you go through them, reading them in order. When I did the James Bond archives originally back, I started that in 2010. I mean, I'd read the occasional James Bond novel, but not all of them growing up, you know, just when I could pick them up. Like you said, in the local secondhand bookstore or junk shop even. But then I thought, well, I've got to do the decent thing. I've got to read them all. So when I was going down to London, in fact, to research at the archives, looking at all the images and all the documentation, etc., for the James Bond archives, I read all the books in order of publication. And one of the things that I noticed, so this was Skyfall was going to be made. It was before Skyfall was in production and during the production that the book was put together. And I thought, oh my God, I didn't realise how damaged Bond is by the experience of becoming a spy. He is, at the beginning, it's all, you know, yada, 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 killing women, smoking, driving fast cars, bit of action. It's all great. But as it goes through it, sort of spoiler alert, it's like he's psychologically damaged by the whole experience. It really, really messes him up. And to such a point where he cannot be trusted by the British Secret Service. There's even a scene where he attempts to kill M. And so, sorry for all these spoilers, John.
It's okay. I have read them all in also in chronological order, but as I say, 10 years ago. So, which book does he try to kill M in?
I'm not.
You're not going to tell me that one. Okay,
I'm not going to tell you all that.
Okay.
But essentially, what this is really this I found very interesting. It's like the whole, if we're talking about fantasy, it's like the fantasy of this character goes wrong. It becomes a sort of nightmare. And so the character is diminished towards the end, you know, by Man with the Golden Gun. It really is diminished. He's been put out to pasture and he's been looked after by Mary Goodnight, if I remember correctly. So this is not a fantasy figure in the way that you would expect a fantasy figure to act. And I think it's also surprising that this is also a period where Bond is at the height of its popularity. He's writing these novels around Dr. No coming out, the film, and From Russia with Love, and then he's gone. So he passes. Fleming passes, and so I think it's really interesting. It's sort of like almost contrarian. It's like something's gone wrong with that fantasy life. I don't know psychologically. I don't know if that was intentional in the case of Fleming, or whether it just crept in and he went with it. But yeah, but the original idea of him writing the character as he gets married, I think that is perhaps telling in one way, but also you've got to remember he was somebody who was going to have to support his wife, who was going to, you know, had certain expectations. She came from a privileged background. He was essentially poor. He was a reporter, and he would then have to support her in some way. And this was really, I think, in the other aspect of this is that he wanted to be a novelist. He wanted to make money from this, also to relive that element, the most exciting element of his life, which was during World War II. He was part of Naval Command, and he would construct these scenarios for armed men, soldiers, to go behind the lines in order to capture intelligence from the Germans before they destroyed that intelligence as the Allies were advancing through World War II. So he couldn't go himself. He wished to. So this was a way for him to relive that experience and to talk about it in a way without being prosecuted under the Official Secrets Act. As others, you know, if we're talking about John le Carré, it's a similar situation. Spy wants to talk about it, can't, writes about the psychological aspects of it. And W. Somerset Maugham, Ashendon. And Fleming knew Maugham as well, so you know they were friendly. So, and also there's an American writer, Charles McCarry. Do you know him? All right, so he's he did The Tears of Autumn and The Better Angels. I just read The Better Angels for the first time. Very, very good. You should look him up. He is also another ex-CIA agent. Who then wrote about, he had a character, Paul Christopher, a series of novels. So, and those are well worth looking up. You can put it in your list there.
Raymond Chandler writes a really positive review in the Sunday Times of Fleming's novel, one of Fleming's novels. I think it's after a couple have been published. And I was really interested. He says this quote, he has this quote, which I loved, where he says, you don't have to work at Fleming's books. He does the work for you. And yeah. I thought that's really interesting because I've always kind of been a bit condescending towards Fleming as a writer. And yeah. I was talking to someone else recently, and we were talking about the sort of not the Bond books which are written by Sebastian Faulks and William Boyd, and a lot of other writers have had John Gardner and Kingsley Amis, and they made the point, and I think it's a very good point. It's these William Boyd is a better writer than Ian Fleming, but his Bond book isn't as good as Fleming's. You know, there's something about Fleming that is he owns that character so thoroughly, and he owns that kind of story and that kind of plot that he does, that everything else looks like pastiche by comparison.
Yeah, I think that this is, he's the originator of the character. I think that when you're writing, I mean, you write, John, you write fiction. There's a certain point where you're in the zone, I think that's the phrase, where you've got a vision for it, where you physically can actually live in that space. And there are two things that happen. I think there's the creative aspect of it in terms of actually being there and visualizing it. And then there's another aspect of it, which is the language or voice. And that comes from finding that voice is often the key. So if, as we were talking earlier about certain writers, they have a certain voice in their writing that you recognize and that you are keyed into in a certain way. And finding that is, I think, for any writer, the most difficult thing to do. But once you have it, you have to cling on to it. And I think Fleming found his voice somehow immediately on the first book, Casino Royale.
Yeah, the very first sentence, you know, the description of 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
You're immediately, I'm in a James Bond novel, you know.
Yeah, but also if you look at his style, it really goes back to somebody like, I'm going to say Paul Kane, who's an old noir novelist. And one of the very striking things about Paul Kane is the way that he absolutely strips out everything extraneous to the story, so that the only words in the story are words that propel you forward. So it's a very, very specific voice. You look at Dashiell Hammett is similar in that way as well. And I think that's one of the keys, is that I just read Murakami's The Wind Up Chronicles, and there were certain longueurs in that where you go, oh yeah, you could have missed out a few, couple of pages there. You know, interesting as they may be, really you've gone on a bit too much. Let's get on with the story and the characters, please. And Fleming, there is no point in any of his novels
that has to be the first time Murakami and Fleming have been compared as literary stylists.
Not the last time, I'm sure. but it is important to if you're going to look at novels and writing style, it's the absolute discipline of doing that. But not only that, the thought process to go into that. He only wrote these in a couple of weeks. It's not like he spent a few weeks writing it and then a year rewriting it, making touch-ups, sending them to his friends, making sure it was accurate, you know, doing due diligence on it, changing the names where necessary. But really, he didn't restructure it. He never, he could take out half a page if he thought he was waffling on it. But no, this comes from newspapers. It comes from knowing that you've got this restricted word space, a certain number of columns, and you have to move that story on. You have to get everything important into that tiny, tiny space, so that even though the novels are short, relatively, in today's day's market, the stories and the characters feel full. And that's key. That's why you could see them as films.
Absolutely, and that's sort of like the next thing I wanted to move on to, because this book that you've just done on Dr. No, I mean, to begin with, I wanted to ask, is this like the first of are you going to be doing a Dr. No and a Russia from Love and is it a series you've got planned?
I wish, but no, there are no plans for that.
Okay.
But seriously, John, there's nothing. It's not been talked about. But there is, I hope they do, because some of the stories from some of the other films are great. I mean, in terms of the making of it, because it's not a book about Dr. No. It's a book about the making of Dr. No.
Yes, so, absolutely.
So that's a completely different story. But no, there isn't a... There are no plans for more.
I mean, this is beautifully illustrated. There's so many good pictures in here, and the level of detail that you have on Dr. No. And if there isn't another book or there isn't another follow-up, this is fine, because Dr. No itself is such a hugely culturally important moment in cinema. And culture just generally. John Higgs was on the podcast a month or two ago, talking about how Dr. No is released the same afternoon as the first Beatles single, "Love Me Do," and it's just like, wow, what a time to be alive.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting that Dr. No was embraced in the UK and in a lot of Europe, in fact, but not in America. it didn't really break through in America. And I don't think it's because the producers complained about, oh, it was released in the sticks, in drive-ins, etc., in America, etc. It was actually released quite extensively. I mean, America's an enormous place. To have any sort of cultural impact there, very, very difficult. I mean, there are countless stories of films and bands and books being released in America and just being duds. It's not a sign of the quality, it's just the whether it connects with an audience or not. But Dr. No did okay in America. It didn't, you know, it didn't shame itself, but it wasn't a cultural phenomenon. And they did bring over Sean Connery for a couple of weeks to do promotion. You know, he did a junket tour, as they would say, a couple of times, you know, going from city to city, did many, many interviews, which was fun, actually, reading them all to see how similar they all turned out to be, as is the case of Junkets.
Had he just basically sort of learned his script? And
No. He basically, they were just asking him the same questions. They they didn't have a clue who he was. So they asked exactly the same questions, which I have to say, any actor or director or anybody in the industry will know exactly how that feels. It's Kafkaesque, really, in the way that people are brought round and asked the same question.
There was a recent, actually a few years ago, when Hugh Laurie became famous in America because of House. There was a clip of how people on talk shows going, and you're actually not American then.
Yeah.
It was like a YouTube compilation. It was stop asking Hugh Laurie that he's not American, not telling him that he's not American. To go back to Sean Connery and rewind a little bit, obviously the big thing, as soon as Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman had the rights to Dr. No, was the casting of James Bond. And it's interesting that when Connery was on board, you talk about him being like, their relationship was right there from the very beginning in terms of that template of he was not going to be an easy character to deal with. He was by no means like going, oh, brilliant, you're giving me my great break. He was like, no, you pay me money for this. And he wasn't pleased with his salary and had to sort of shout about it.
Well, I think that he had bad experiences in the past with Disney in America. So he'd done was it Darby Gill and Little People?
Exactly.
So he'd been groomed as this, you know, handsome young man, blah, blah, blah. And I think what happened was that he had educated himself in the world of acting. And also he'd taken the whole idea of acting very seriously. He did stage productions and he did TV productions, quality material. Anna Karenina, he was the lead in Requiem for a Heavyweight, which is like, you know, a great physical role, but also a heavy emotional role. He'd done films, but he'd never really broken out as an actor. In fact, probably Daniel Craig had broken out. He'd done some great things, Our Friends from the North, for example, just amazing. But Connery hadn't really had that really breakout role. He'd been misused. He had all these qualities. And I think that what Saltzman even said it at one point, that he was a good actor in horrible films. He'd always been miscast or misused. And so I think that they understood that he had the qualities that they needed for the role. But they were producers. Let's face it, Harry Saltzman had been the producer on the Angry Young Men movies, you know, the original Look Back in Anger, The Entertainer, Saturday Night, Sunday Morning. So if anything, he understood the idea of the modern age, that James Bond, or Sean Connery as James Bond, was an angry young man. that's what we're talking about. We're talking about people breaking through and not being happy. They're not there to stand there and smile and take everything. You know, they were direct, forward, violent if necessary. I mean, you look at Richard Burton in Look Back in Anger, incredible performance. I mean, obviously he was miscast in a way because he was far too old, but he makes you understand the role. So there's that aspect of he dealt with that. And also Cubby had long experiences with filmmaking and Warwick Films. He'd made films with people like Robert Mitchum, Jack Palance, Alan Ladd. None of these people you would think of as easy people to work with. You know, they understood that actors and actresses were a breed apart. They didn't need to be handled. They just need to be corralled and put in the right place at the right time with the right people, the right product, and, you know, that they will perform.
So we have, I mean, I think it's been spoken about enough, the sort of the various sort of other names that have been floated about James Bond. Sure. Let's stick with Connery for the moment, and we'll and go into the actual sort of the making of the film. I mean, one of the reasons Dr. No was chosen as a book, it's not the first chronological book. It was to do with budget, right? It was because Thunderball was initially one of the possible, lies another sort of long story.
So Thunderball was the new novel that had just come out. So normally if you're doing, so it should be said that the producers, Harry and Cubby, when they went to United Artists, they had a very, very short time for an option on the James Bond novel to help out Ian Fleming on his medical expenses that he just incurred. He just had a terrible heart attack, and also a lawsuit that was upcoming, because what happened was that Thunderball was his latest novel, but it had been based on a film script that he'd been working on, and so he was being sued because of that. Now the producers they wanted to go ahead, Harry and Cubby, they actually wanted to go ahead with Thunderball as the first film. Also, they liked Dr. No, because it's essentially one location, Jamaica, very exotic, and then interiors. You don't need to look any further. And Thunderball seemed a bit more wide-ranging, but they'd handle it. They'd go to the British West Indies, Bahamas, to do that. And this was all planned. They had scripts for both written, but it became clear they met with the producer, McClory, who was suing Fleming.
This is Kevin McClory, who wrote the original treatment.
He was the original producer, and there was a screenwriter who sold all his rights to McClory. And they met with McClory, and McClory said, well, this is going to be serious and it's going to maybe take a while. So they realized that they couldn't go ahead with Thunderball, even though they had a script and they'd worked out a production schedule for it. And it was going to be filmed in the Bahamas, and for the studio, it was going to be Shepperton, not Pinewood. So there's a whole alternative universe
in which Thunderball is the first Bond movie, and that's fascinating.
Yeah, and also there's an alternative universe later on. Instead of doing You Only Live Twice, that Connery actually did on the Majesty's Secret Service.
Oh my God, that would have been so good with Peter Hunt directing. You know, that would have been.
Can you imagine that? I mean, with anybody directing, it would have been Lewis Hamilton Lewis Gilbert or Hamilton. So it was Guy Hamilton. So that's an alternative. That's another what if. But yeah, so they thought, well, we've got to go with Dr. No. we can't do Thunderball. It's going to drag out for a long time. It's not going to be, they're not going to agree to disagree, or they're not going to make an agreement outside of court. So they thought, oh, well, I have to go with Dr. No. And that's when both Wolf Mankiewicz and Richard Maybaum went ahead and started working together on rewriting. So there was a lot of rewriting on that in order to get a script, a shooting script. Now, I should say that the shooting scripts, I read them all, and, you know, I've detailed them all. I tried to do due diligence to include everything in the book so that people have an idea of really what the plots were, but also the tone, because the tone changes a lot between the different scripts. Some of them are ultra serious. Some of them completely ignore Fleming's plot. Famously, Dr. No is a monkey.
Another alternative.
Yes. And just as a figurehead, it was the idea is like the Wizard of Oz type thing, of just having a figurehead, but really somebody else in control. And but what I thought was interesting is that the tones, it sort of went way too serious, way too campy, way too serious, way too campy. And it was when Terence Young came on board and actually took the script by the scruff of the neck. What he did was he aggregated them all. He took the best elements, the best parts of them, put them into a workable script. But also the tone that he took was very much, I think, the black humour, the dark humour of people who have been in war or in the services. If you think of people who've worked as police, firemen, people in very, very stressful jobs, they use black comedy in order to take the tension away from the job at hand or the moment at hand, in order to release the tension. And Terence Young, he'd been a tank commander during World War II. That sort of humour was absolutely the sort of thing that he would have experienced during the war. Yes. And that's what he made. That's really where the humour of Bond comes from, because it's not in the novels. You know, this is the sort of humour that men of action would use. And So Terence Young, I would say, is probably the physical embodiment of Ian Fleming. He had, James Bond, because he had that, he lived life to the full. There's all the money that he spent, not just on James Bond and on his previous movies, he was always in debt, because anytime he had any money, he spent it. He spent the money he didn't have. On Dr. No, they even withheld money from his paycheck because they knew what he was like. This is not the producers, I should say. This is Film Finances, who did the completion bond on. They'd had previous experience with Terence Young. They knew exactly what he was like. So he would be very happy. Right, champagne all around.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
This is him living life to the full, like James Bond lives life to the full, not because he wants to show off, because the character, the essence of the character is each day, each hour, each minute, each moment of his life could be his last, right? Therefore, let's enjoy it. Live now, pay later, yeah? Mm-hmm. And Terence Young was absolutely like that. And he had the suits, he had the upbringing, he had the swagger. I think at one point Connery was said to have copied his walk. Terence Young trained Connery in how to wear suits, how to eat at restaurants, what to order, the whole thing. He just like coached him all the way through. Connery just absorbed everything, like all good actors. You know, when you see something that's right, that's on the money. And that's what he did. Connery even started having having a cigarette with a holder and stuff, as Fleming did. And so these are all little bits and pieces that Connery got into the role in order to become Bond, which I don't think answered your question, but anyway.
Well, you brought up a piece of something which I thought was interesting as well, though, because we're talking about like the differences and the evolution of Bond. Dr. No is sort of regarded by many as being as being quite close to the novel plot-wise.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Certainly more than will happen when we get to things like the Roger Moore Bonds. And
yeah, but there's no giant squid in Dr.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Don't know.
Yeah, yeah, that's but you can kind of see those changes as a sort of budgetary, you know, yeah. Can we do this and not look ridiculous? Well, what other changes did you think? What other processes of evolution happened moving from Fleming into the more filmic Bond that Dr. No would introduce?
Well, I think the first thing you've got to remember is that the film Bond is not the Fleming Bond, that they are different. I think the closest we psychologically would get to it is really on Dalton in A License to Kill and the Daniel Craig. The whole idea of Daniel Craig's dissolution and going mad, if you like, his breakdown as a character really follows the novels more closely, and I think that's probably the thing that Daniel Craig liked about. But on Dr. No, they were creating a character who moved, and I think that the psychologically the key moment in the whole movie, if you like, the first half of the movie is really an investigation, like any film noir. James Bond is trying to find out where he is, who are the good guys, who are the bad guys. Jack Lord, is he a good guy or a bad guy? Yeah. So always it's about investigation. But there's a very specific point where Professor Dent, again, good guy or bad guy, comes in and tries to kill Bond. Bond is in waiting for him. We see that Bond, we're not told, we're shown that Bond seduces Taro, the girl who's been spying and passing on information. He then hands her over to the police. He then sets up her place in the mountains in order to make it look like there'd been a night of drink and carousing, an old word there, and then takes out some playing cards, plays solitaire, and an ashtray as he waits for the assassin to arrive to kill him. So this is the first time really that you see him at work as somebody who is licensed to kill. So the tone of the movie changes, and then Dent comes in, fires into a bed which has been set up, plumped up to make it look as though Bond is there. And in fact, if you think about it, he was going to shoot Miss Taro as well. Yeah, they were both supposed to be in bed together. And then Bond calmly has a talk, tries to extract information, And then he knows that Dent has no bullets left. You've had your six. And then shoots him in cold blood. And then when the body is on the floor, shoots him again. Now, this has no equivalence in Fleming. So you will not, this has been created. And I think it's important to realize that this is a cinematic device so that you understand that the tone of the movie has changed. It's all been a bit of a fun sort of, you know, with the nice Jamaican music, Byron Lee and the Dragonaires and going here, there and everywhere and, you know, all these exotic characters. But Terence Young, I mean, it's a blinder of a scene. It's really, really excellent. Not only that, there's something else as well, which is that they had to film it multiple times because with different versions, because they didn't know whether they'd be able to get away with this. And so they had to film a version where Dent actually fires back, misses Bond and then Bond, so that Bond is reacting rather than being the anti-hero. Because that's what he is. He's an anti-hero. He kills somebody in cold blood. He is not he is not a nice man. You know, this is something which I think sometimes people may forget because of all the other aspects of it. That really, you don't want to go into a bar and meet a killer. This is not something that you should wish upon yourself.
I mean, this is something that was realized at the time as well, because people were already criticizing the novels as sort of like, oh, it's sadistic and it's this and that. They weren't, you know, I mean, it was something. And also, I think sometimes when people go back and rewatch these films, they're a little bit surprised and shocked by, they're not the fluffy Roger Moore-y sort of.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, oh, he treats, you know, in Goldfinger, he's, you know, that isn't that rape? And it's like, it's kind of all of a piece with that character.
Yeah. I mean, these are not, you know, nowadays we have warnings on things like this. But that is something that is new. This is part of why Bond became so popular, not because he was sadistic, but because it was more realistic. So previously, you would have the clubbable heroes, you know, the John Buchan school, the saint, and these other characters who always had a flair, but were fair. Yeah, this is like, they were likable. And they were the wrong man, in a sense, as the Hitchcock movies show, in that they had an excuse for the things that they did. Bond has no excuse. This is his job. And that distinction distinguished him from what had come before and ushered on a new age. This is, if you like, he opened the door for people like John le Carré, and the spy who came in from the cold, and for Len Deighton as well, the Harry Palmer stuff, although he was unnamed in the novels. So this is a different, we're moving into a different age, right, where the idea of spies and spycraft are becoming serious because of the Cold War. Which is
something funny, that because it would often be the other way around, that people would say, well, John le Carré is a serious one and Ian Fleming is not Ian Fleming necessarily, but the Bond is the fantasy version.
Yeah, but Bond always takes from what's happening in the world, what's just happened and what's about to happen. There is the first versions of the Dr. No script were about weapons in Cuba, you know, which became the 13 days and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Which wasn't used, you know, as a story. It has nothing to do with Fleming. But Fleming did base those incidents, the idea of toppling missiles did come from actual cases that that he'd seen reported. He did take from news events in order. Those are the things that informed his stories. And in fact, in the production itself, you do all of that equipment that you see in the communications room is real communications equipment that was due for the New Delhi airport. The stuff that you see in the reactor room, the nuclear reactor room, is actually equipment. A lot of it is equipment that was for nuclear reactor. You know, it was based on deep research. Mm. They had technical people on hand, as is the case of the casino. They used real chips, real plaques for that. That had to be insured because they really were worth, you know, £15,000 or whatever, which was a chunk of money in 1962. So yeah, that attention to detail and reality. I mean, I was surprised, really surprised, at that, because we do, as you say, we think of them as being maybe a little bit quaint, because they are, you know, so long ago, more than 60 years. So, but no, they did have a basis in reality. And even though plot-wise they are a bit simple, they are extremely direct and psychologically true. So Honey Rider, for example, is a wild child, right? But she has had some terrible experiences in her life, which explain, you know, that when the first time she sees Bond, she takes out a knife and is ready to defend herself. There's a lot going on, and that's really what I was trying to do in the book, is to show the work that everybody in all the departments put into the presentation and depiction of the movie.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to come back to as well, is that whole idea that Dr. No is kind of like the James Bond series in Genesis, even though while they're making it, they're not entirely sure there will be another one. They're hoping there will be. They're setting it up as a series, but...
Yeah, they had a commitment from United Artists for a series of films. And United Artists, they were saying, well, we can sort of afford about $1 million for each one, but no more. So it was sold as a series. And have you seen all the... in the contracts and all the publicity, it's about a new series of movies. I mean, obviously, I think if it had tanked in the UK, I think that would have been it. But the fact is, it was one of the most successful films in the UK, certainly for that year. And because of that, it made its money back, essentially, that and Europe. So they knew that, okay, we wiped our face on that. We're coming out more than 6 months later in America. You can start on the new one. You can start on the second one. So they did have that aspect of there being, it was set up as a series from the beginning. Connery was contracted for a series. So that was the intent. And to this day, I think it's incredible. Can you imagine going to a film studio saying, right, we've got this property, this IP, as you would say now, right, we don't have a star for it, can you give us some money? It's just like, not for one, but for a series. You sort of go, no, maybe not. That aspect of it, I think, is amazing. But they did have David Picker, an exec at United Artists, who had wanted to make a series on James Bond previously and had looked for the rights. So they had a friend on the inside, even though they didn't know it when they turned up.
The constituent parts of that series then begin to emerge in Dr. No. You know, you have the Bond girl, Honey Child.
I think you're talking about the format. The format, but Yeah, so you have the little cold open at the beginning where you see the murder of Strangways. Then you have Bond being introduced. Then you have the briefing.
And you said Bond, James Bond, comes from the Thunderball script, not the Dr. No script.
Not from the novels either.
Right.
I mean, people say maybe it's from the novel, but Bond, James Bond, comes from Richard Mayborn. There's a point at which Bond is introduced. The actual word is introduced in the Thunderball script. And then when Mankiewicz and Mayborn worked together on the Dr. No script, that Bond book, James Bond, transferred over. However, I don't think Bond, James Bond, is really important in the introduction. What's important is that the way that Terence Young directed and set up and directed that scene, because what he did is he copied a film, Juarez, that he'd seen. Young was a writer, it must be said. He started as a screenwriter, and he was a great film buff, and he knew a good, as well as directing previous movies, when he saw a good movie or a good moment, he knew it.
Mm.
And in Juarez, the central character is introduced from the back. So you don't see him, and people talk about him, and then there's a point where the camera moves around and he's then introduced as Suarez. And Terence Young loved that. He thought it was a great way to introduce a character. And in fact, all the main characters, they all get a great introduction. It's a very Hollywood thing. That, you know, the whole idea of the central character entering by having the slow walk down the stairs, or, you know, or a certain word, or there has to be a setup. I mean, the ultimate is obviously Harry Lime in The Third Man. Mm. Spend half the movie talking about him, yeah? And then there's a cat at his feet, a light comes on, and he's sort of looking up, you know, smirking with a twinkle in his eye.
Yeah, saying, oh, you were wondering when Orson Welles would turn up, and here I am.
Yeah, but this is important. And what Terence Young did, he set up Bond in the same way. You see him. In fact, the first day of filming on the casino set, which was, you know, they'd filmed in Jamaica for weeks. Then they'd had about a week in at Pinewood Studios, and then they moved to the casino set. The first day of the casino was really him being framed and moved in order to hide who he was.
Mm.
So mm. all of those concentrated on Sylvia Trench, all her scenes, the camera being in that position. So Sean Connery was doing all the lines, etc. And then when the camera on the second day, when it turned around for on the other side of the table, and you're looking at Bond for those scenes, sort of long, medium, close up. For that moment where he says Bond, James Bond, they did 9 takes, and each time it would be slightly different. So what Terence Young was looking for, I think, is a rhythm to the whole thing. Film is a musical form. It's about rhythm. It's about editing, cutting to a rhythm. You either the cuts or the action within the frame all have a certain rhythm to it. And he's trying to find this. When, you know, when Harrison Ford ridicules, or people take it as ridicule, that that George Lucas says to him on the set of Star Wars, faster, more intense. Yeah, he's not really ridiculing. What's happened is Harrison Ford has come on set, and the director dictates the rhythm of the action, the rhythm of the dialogue. And once they have it, like finding a voice for a writer, once they have it, once they know it, they give actors that clue to say, right, you need to make this a little bit faster. You need to be a bit harsher on this. You need to slow down here. Because not because the actor is doing anything wrong, But within the whole context of the movie, there is a certain rhythm and pace. Sometimes you need to slow it down, sometimes you need to speed it. And what Terence Young found in that movement was that Bond is lighting a cigarette at the same time. That's the action. So at what point does he put the cigarette in his mouth? At what point does he say the words? At what point does he light it and inhale? Those things have to be choreographed. So it's Bond, flick, light, James Bond. Yeah. Mm. So once he'd found that, right, that print, it's gone. If you have a look at all of the, because I had complete access to all the extent documents on there. And as you know, from going through the book, I go into incredible detail about the number of takes, the changes in the setup, how they changed and moved the camera, because I want to show in the book physically how you make a movie in the early 60s. You know, it's not like making a movie now. And if you have a look, mostly Terence Young only did 1, 2, 3 takes, and that was it. And he only had one take to use. Very, 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 very little to work with. But on this one, he went to 9 takes because he knew how important it was. Mm. And he knew that once he had it, he had it. And so it's not just Bond, James Bond. It's Bond, James Bond.
Yeah.
You know, the whole rhythm and choreography is what makes that scene.
I love the way that's also it's genuinely a piece of dialogue. It's her saying "Mister" and him answering. Yeah. It's not just him turning up as he will do in later movies and say the name's Bond, James Bond. It's sort of like Mister Bond, James Bond.
Yeah, because she also introduces herself as Trench, Sylvia Trench. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yes, yes, yes. That's something I noticed last time.
Yeah. So this is within courtship, you know, it's called mirroring.
Yeah, where it's you like mirror two peacocks.
So he's following her, the rhythm of her speech in order to ingratiate himself with her.
Wow.
So in order to pick her up. So it is a seduction technique as well. No, I think it's this fascinates me. Another thing about Terence Young is that I started to notice that in all of the way that he broke down a scene, the way that he was going to film it, he always started with the beginning and end of a scene were always the same, always from the outside. And then the heart of the scene, the heart of the dialogue, he would put in, he would bring the camera in so that the characters, you would be closer to the characters. But he never did full coverage. So he never did a master shot, as they would call it in Hollywood, where you would do the whole scene from long distance, then the whole scene middle, and then the whole scene in close-up. So that there was only a very specific... Well, it was much quicker to do it the way he was doing it, but also it meant that there was only one way to cut it.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's Hitchcock and Ford did the same thing. It was like, I'm not letting any editor just...
Yeah.
You know, I'm cutting it in the camera.
Yeah, yeah. And this is a way for him to control, as I said, the rhythm and pace of the whole thing. But it's also it's a way of getting through the day quicker.
Yeah, right, right. And then you can...
Yeah.
We're coming to the end of our conversation, and it shows how much there is in the book, how much there is about Dr. No that's interesting, fascinating, that we haven't even mentioned so many important elements here. Ursula Andress.
Ken Adam.
Ken Adam.
Peter
John
Hunt.
Barry. Peter Hunt, you know, just...
Norman Wanstall on the sound.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, there's so many elements to this that are vital. So I just get, you know, as a final sort of wrap up, what would you, you know, if you could sort of make good those absences and those ellipses for us?
So shall I just read the whole book out for you?
Well, no. No, but, okay, so everybody buy the book, number one.
No,
and number two, what would you sort of pick up on something we haven't said?
Well, I think for me, all right, for me as a project, the important thing for me was that I wanted to put the reader in the situation where they are going through the whole production. Normally, we've seen that there are great film books where people are on set and they have on-set diaries, etc., because they were there, right? But the majority of movies, and often key movies, do not have that that paperwork or that book which explains what happened and why and how things came about. And the reason this happened is because they didn't have this, so they had to make a change. Or and I wanted to do that type of book. I've never done that type of book before, and I had an opportunity where I could lead the reader through every process, every discipline of filmmaking at that time. And I think it was really a once in a lifetime opportunity to do this. Not only giving you the pictures, I have complete access to all the photography. There was a lot of stuff that was actually not there within the Eon archive, because at that time they did not keep a lot of materials. They would send original negs, etc., out to photo agencies. Luckily, I had a lot of there were a lot of James Bond fans who collected this material, and they gave me access to this so that I can include it in the book for the first time. There were also all the documents that I wanted to reproduce and show so that you could read them. You know, it's not just me telling you, but
oh yeah, I love that, the letters for, that sort of back and forth. And
yeah, and sometimes they're unreadable, the handwriting. So I've spent ages trying to decipher them, and I've included like the full texts in some of the letters. And you get a real sense of what the real ebb and flow of emotion is on these books, in this film. And for me, that's what I wanted. I wanted to show that, and also to show that how much of it was planned and how much was accident and was just good luck. I mean, let's face it, Ursula Andress did not have a screen test. Mm. Normally you would have for a movie, you would have the main actor and the main actress would come together and they would have a screen test to see if they had chemistry. You know, if they could fit in the same frame, what they looked like, if they got on, yeah. If they reacted, if there was a certain twinkle in their eyes and they had the same sense of humor, you know, these are the sort of things that had to be tested. And they had these two actors, Sean Connery, Ursula Andress, came together. And this was after 2 weeks of filming. Ursula Andress turned up, and the first thing they had to do was sit in a boat in Jamaica and kiss for the end scene. And they got on like a house on fire. They had chemistry, in life and on screen. And that, I think, that was just pure luck. And so much of this is planned, and so much of this is luck. You know, if you get Ken Adam and you give him, they went completely over budget to such an extent that film finances had to take over the finances. They had to physically take the bank accounts off the producers in order to in post-production, because they had gone over budget so much. And the reason they'd gone over budget is because the producers let Ken Adam go wild, basically fulfill his vision. And they let him fulfill that vision while they were in Jamaica. You know, he was building and designing and building these sets in Pinewood while everybody else was in Jamaica. It's just like, it's not best practice, I don't think.
Fingers crossed. Exactly. Yeah.
But they had faith. They'd worked with a lot of these people before. Ted Moore, the cinematographer, amazing cinematography. Ken Adam. They'd worked with a lot of these people before. And so they had faith in them. And sometimes the best thing you can do as a producer is to do nothing. Just let people get on with what they're good at doing. And they gave Ken Adam his head. Bigger than life is, you know, what he, that was his sort of phrase. He wanted to create something that was bigger than life, that went that little bit extra, that used new materials that you would not find ordinarily. And new materials that you would not have seen in real life to create these structures in order to bring it a little bit, you know, just 2 or 3 years into the future. And that whole thing came together. When you're making a movie, you never know whether the characters are going to work, whether the plot is going to work, whether the direction is going to work, or whether it's going to connect to an audience. These are all unknowables that create incredible tension on the set, especially if you're going way over budget. And that's what I wanted to capture. I wanted to capture that tension and unknowability of the future to put you there day by day, because it's structured day by day in the present tense. And I wanted to bring you through that. That sort of reconstruction I hadn't really seen before in film book. It'd always been a dream of mine, and I'm happy to have actually done it.
It's such an exciting way of looking at that and sort of going back in time and experiencing that again. It's a great documentary in book form of that process, which I think is also fascinating. Even if, I mean, obviously the core audience is going to be people who are fascinated by Bond movies, Bond fans. But even if you were just interested in the history of filmmaking in the 1960s, this would be
I talk about financing. Always a showstopper talking about financing. But also Norman Wanstall giving, who's still with us, giving us the, it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant talking with him, because he gave me a real sense of how things were edited and put together with sound effects. I mean, the silencer that Bond uses, killing Professor Dent, that sound had never been heard in movies before. He created that sound. Yeah. And so he created it by joining together different sound ingredients and editing them together. And there were lots of sounds like that he had to create for the movie, as well as taking from sound library. And then the whole process of how do you actually dub? It's fascinating that, you know, the number of the actual physical process of making these movies. And that's what I wanted to, that was part of the thing that I wanted to do about it. And also trouble with the unions, you know, where they, all the sort of nitty gritty behind the scenes bits, they had at one point, they moved from the south of Jamaica in Kingston to the north of Jamaica, where all the beaches are. There was unemployment in Jamaica, and people turned up at the hotel looking for jobs. So many people that it was preventing them from actually filming. These are all the sort of day-to-day things, unexpected things that happen. Boats not turning up at the beach. They turn up at midday instead of 6 a.m. because there was no culture of filmmaking there. They had no filmmaking base there. They had no television at that time. They had no professional actors in Jamaica. They only had a little theatre, which is why most of the actors came from the little theatre networks, which were amateur theatre. So it was all those little niggles and bits and pieces. And I think they helped to convey the reality of making movies at that time.
Yeah, I love all that stuff. I've just finished reading Ed Zwick's memoir, and so much of his career is, you know, he's talking about little accidents of fate and little, you know, and incorporating them, and, you know, some mistake that suddenly becomes the solution, you know. Okay, well, we've got to come back. Well, I'll tell you what. When I did my Casino Royale Bond podcast read through, mm-hmm. James Bond Book Club, it will be called.
Yeah, well, of course.
And
Are you just going to do Fleming? Or are you going to do them all?
Oh God! Well, let me. I've got to spend some time when I'm not on a podcast.
I'm afraid not. Your life is a podcast now. It's the Truman Show all over again. Okay, I'll let you get on, John, because we've got life and food to deal with. All right, my pleasure, John. You take care and try and live a little bit life and read a few books and watch a few movies.
Okay? I'll do my best.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.